Today on Wings, the history of the feminist press for its 50th anniversary.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. The feminist press, based in New York, is known worldwide for republishing lost masterpieces by women. The director of the feminist press, Florence Howe, described the history of the press during a promotional tour in 1992.
One of the first things I get asked all the time is, what were things like 21 years ago? They were very different. If you went into a bookstore, Mrs. Dalloway, you might find in paperback, and you might find one volume of Willa Cather. You'd find The Second Sex maybe in a paperback, because I taught it in the 60s. You would find no black women writers on the shelf. None. You would find very little black literature. You would find no Hispanic literature. Certainly nothing by Japanese Americans or other Asian Americans or Native Americans. And you'd find precious little by women. I never heard of any of the writers we've published these 20 years at the Feminist Press. I went to Mississippi in 64, and I learned that my students in Mississippi had a subject to write about, freedom and blackness, that my white students at Goucher College didn't have. So I came back to Goucher College at the end of that summer trying to figure out why my uneducated black students could write really brilliant poems and essays, and why my educated white students were really dead in the head and couldn't write anything that mattered to anyone, least of all to them. And so I started playing around. I asked them to write about whiteness. Well, they didn't know anything about whiteness. And so the next thing I tried was, what was your life like growing up as a girl? And they said, oh, we don't want to talk about that. That's boring. And I said, well, I'd like to talk about that. Tell me about that. And they got very angry. And the minute they got angry, I knew I was onto something. And so I persisted. And I looked around for books about growing up female, and there was very little I could find. I mean, I did find The Second Sex. I did find A Room of One's Own. Didn't tell me a whole lot. I found Doris Lessing, taught Martha Quest for a while. I taught The Golden Notebook. I found Mary McCarthy. My students hated all these books. They kept saying, why do we have to read these lady writers? They're terrible. We want to be writers, but we want to be Hemingway and Fitzgerald. And of course, it occurred to me, I could say to them, you will never be Hemingway and Fitzgerald. But I didn't really know what the problems were. That was my consciousness raising. That was 1964, 65, 66. By 69, my students were saying, what about the literature courses? I was teaching women writers in the writing courses, and I was getting good writing. But they wanted to know about my 18th century course. Why were there no women writers in it? I didn't know the answer to that question. But I began to look around, and by 1969, I was asking the people who had published me, book publishers and the New York Review of Books, whether they'd be interested in a series of books by and about women. And everywhere I went, I got the same answer, especially from the financial thinkers of these presses. It's a wonderful idea, but there's no money in it. And there's no money in it settled it. So I went away after 6 or 7 tries. And I had a husband at that time who was quite imaginative. And he said, why not do it yourself? And I laughed. And I said, you can't do a press yourself. I'd started a magazine with a couple of other people called The Radical Teacher, which is still in existence. But there's quite a difference between a magazine and a press. And I knew that. So I went to Baltimore Women's Liberation, and I asked them what they thought of the idea. They thought it was wonderful, but they were all too busy. It was like Chicken Little, right? I said, will anyone help me? And no, 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 no. So I went home, furious, and said, forget the whole thing, to Baltimore Women's Liberation, and I took my family and went to Cape Cod for the month of August. When I got back, in my mailbox, there were about 100 envelopes with a lot of checks, all written to the feminist press. At my home address, 5504 Green Spring Avenue, Baltimore, Maryland, and I was really furious. Baltimore Women's Liberation had decided to announce the existence of this press, even though I had said I am not doing it alone, and I'd stomped out of the meeting in a rage. Not only did they announce it, they said that the press was doing biographies and non-sexist books for children. Now that really got me into a rage because A, I knew nothing about books for children. If asked, I would have said I never want to have anything to do with books for children. Well, what had happened was that there was a woman at Baltimore Women's Liberation who had a 7-year-old who wanted to be a doctor girl. She had looked for books in this same month that I was away, and there were no books about women doctors, and she decided, well, we needed a set of non-sexist children's books, and so, you know, the feminist press was going to take care of that problem, too. Well, I stormed around for about a month and then decided that I had to deal with the mail, and I called a meeting in my house November 17th, 1970, and said that if 20 people came out of the 100 who had written and agreed to work, that we would have a feminist press. Otherwise, everyone would get their checks back. And I'd really forget the whole idea. Well, of course, people came. Cynthia Secor came from Philadelphia. Some people came from Washington, D.C. It was a very interesting meeting. And we, of course, immediately began work on, guess what, the easiest thing, which was the children's book. And it happened, I had a book called I Want to Be a Doctor, which was a Chinese children's book someone had smuggled in from Canada. And in it, two little fat Chinese children, a boy and a girl. The girl is the doctor and the boy is the nurse. That's the startling thing about that little book. And so I handed it to a very talented sophomore student I had named Barbara Danish. And I said, Barbara, let's have an American version. Only please, Barbara, no dragons. Barbara had filled my office with paper mache dragons bigger than I and with big drawings of dragons, and she was in her dragon phase. I shouldn't have said that to Barbara because, of course, the book turned out to be perfectly charming. It was our first book, The Dragon and the Doctor, and it was she and the woman she still lives with who spent the next 9 months at a Xerox place learning to do color separations and actually producing the book. In the meantime, Tilly Olson came along and handed us Life in the Iron Mills. And that was our very, very first discovery that answered the question of my students, that is, what were women doing in the 18th century, the 19th century, and before? They were, of course, writing, only their writings disappeared. But Life in the Iron Mills is a novella, not quite a novel, published anonymously in The Atlantic in 1861 by a woman who was a Quaker and who lived in Wheeling, West Virginia, which was a border state, who, as far as we know, had been to no college. Her mother was dead, and she nursed an ailing father, and her brother had gone off to fight as a member of the Confederate Army. Her father was on the Union side, and she produced this extraordinary story and sent it off to the Atlantic. And she said it had to be published anonymously because she knew that if it had a woman's name on it, nobody would read it or take it seriously. Hawthorne, when he read it, said, who is the writer of this story? He is the next genius of the age. And the editor, of course, told Hawthorne it was a woman, and Hawthorne said, fine, invite her. She couldn't come to Boston and Lexington to meet these people until 1865, when the war was over and her brother came back, because white middle-class women could not travel on trains except escorted by males, members of their families, especially if they were not married. We know about the story that Tilly had read this story when she was 15 in Omaha, Nebraska, but she never knew who wrote it until she read Emily Dickinson's letters or journals, I don't know which, in the 60s. And Emily Dickinson had found out who had written this story and had written her name in the stuff that Tilly was reading. And so Tilly then decided she would find out everything she could about Rebecca Harding Davis. And when Tilly handed this to me, she told me not to read it at night. She said, read it in the morning when you're fresh. And of course, I never listen to directions of that sort, and I'm always a little rebellious anyway, and so it seemed to me that was silly. I read it at night. I did not sleep that night. I just wept. It is a very, very moving story. Not only that, but it's as good as anything Tolstoy ever wrote, or Chekhov, or any of the great masters of the American short story. And it made me ask a lot of questions, like why had I never heard of this writer, even though I had a near PhD in English and had been teaching English literature for a great many years. It also made me wonder whether, since in her day people knew this was a great story, it made me wonder whether there might be other things lost out there. And of course, Tilly then supplied the answer to that question very readily because she produced Daughter of Earth by Agnes Smedley, which also bowled me over, and then Elaine Hedges produced The Yellow Wallpaper by Charlotte Perkins Gilman. So we had three hits in a row, and all three things, two of them about working class people, made me realize that there was a lot more to be found out there. We then invented a reprints advisory committee consisting of about 12 literary scholars and 12 historians. And some of their names are quite famous now, and they were all young, feisty, male and female feminists then, some black, some white. And together we began to outline not only what was needed, but how we could find these things and how we would read in order to find them. And for every book we decided to publish, and we could only do about three or four a year, for every book we agreed to do, we turned down about 100 that we could have done. We were looking for literary excellence, perfection, really, and the historians had to agree that this book was going to be as valuable in a history course as in a literature course. The women's movement, at least for me, kept saying to everyone that history was the most important single thing that had been denied to us as women. And it seemed to me that the literature I read over and over again told me more history than the history books, which were all about laws and wars. At any rate, by 1973-74, we set as our goals the literary work of black women and white working class women, saying we would move on to Hispanic women and other women of color as soon as we could find works. We then set out to find Zora Neale Hurston.
One of the press's most enduring classics is I Love Myself When I Am Laughing, a collection of works by Zora Neale Hurston.
Alice Walker put together the anthology. She and I were both looking for the rights to Their Eyes Were Watching God, which is Zora Neale Hurston's only novel. And we both discovered at the same time that the University of Illinois had them tied up. We couldn't have them, but we could have the rights to all of these pieces of larger works. And this book came out in 1979 when Zora was absolutely unknown and when a publicity person we had hired to help us with this was so impatient. She said, why can't you do writers like Alice Walker? Why are you doing this person? She's unknown. And we tried to, you know, explain over and over again, that's why we are doing her. Now, of course, Zora is a household name in some parts of the literary universe, but nobody had heard of her when we started, and the same for Mara Delasour and the same for Agnes Smedley. So for the first decade, we focused on American writers, black and white, working class, and a couple of middle class writers. Beginning in 1980, we began to look across the ocean, and we found the Agnes Smedley of Sweden, for instance, whose name is Moa Martinson, and who really mirrored Agnes Smedley's life with one exception. Instead of the abortions Agnes had, Moa had five children without marrying Harry Martinson, who eventually became her husband and who was a Nobel Prize winner in Sweden. But Moa wrote her own five or six novels and is absolutely brilliant. One of them is called Women and Apple Trees, and another one is called My Mother Gets Married. And again, she's a working class, self-taught writer who is remarkable for telling the story of the class that most people know nothing about. We then turned to Egypt, Bangladesh, and India, and began to produce works by writers, many of whom were their country's first feminists. Next, Women Writing in India, 600 BC to the present, in two volumes, will be out. And our argument has been to funders here, who who have been especially unwilling to fund such things as the India book, that Indians who live in this country, I mean Asian Indians, also have a history. Their history is in India, and this history happens to be a very long history. 2,600 years in the West, women have only been writing for 900 years? Less? Less. Women were writing in 600 BC. That is not only, therefore, the history of Indian women, it's the history of all women if you want to identify with women who have been writers. So I thought this was extremely important, yet funding agencies who are willing to fund women of color projects, if they are American-based, will not fund international ones like this. We're doing this anyway. We're always, we think, a little ahead of the times. So from 72 to 82, we were mostly 80% on soft money for projects and 20% on book sales and sales of other things. We're now just the reverse, but we still have no core support.
You're listening to a Wings program featuring Florence Howe, director of the Feminist Press. At this point in her speech, Howe acknowledged a $200,000 gift from board member Genevieve Vaughn, which bailed out the press in the 1980s. She went on to say that 1991 figures showed $650,000 in book sales and foreign rights and an $850,000 budget. Howe went on to describe the relationship between the Feminist Press and City University of New York.
The support we have from the university right now is our free rent. The space we have, we don't pay rent for, and I get a tenured professor's salary and I have for the last 5 years, and am released from teaching to run the press. That's the university's contribution. Before that, no teaching, no money. I mean, you know, I used to teach at a different university, but it became impossible increasingly to keep the press going and teach. So from 72 to 82, we ran the press mostly on soft money for book projects. The way we got money to print the Zora volume was that we asked Toni Morrison to write a begging letter for us, which she did. It went out to a couple of thousand people, and we raised $9,000, which was what the printing bill was. Such things have really tripled now. At any rate, we tried to learn how to market and how to be very businesslike. And that, to some extent, has paid off. We have managed to stay alive. But if you don't have capital and you succeed, which is exactly what's happening to us now, we're doing better than we have ever done. If you don't have capital, do you know what you have to have in an economy like ours? You have to have debt. Debt. Because the debt is your capital. So you have to be able to borrow money in order to pay for book publishing. The thing about book publishing is just like manufacturing anything. You have to pay for what you manufacture before you earn the money back on it. And that's capitalism. Okay? So at any moment in time, we are owed about $160,000. But that $160,000 is often not payable to us for a year. So we carry about $200,000 in debt now, thanks to a black credit union in Harlem, the only institution in New York City willing to lend us any money at all, and to a vice president of a printing house, a woman, who owns one-third of a printing firm in Michigan, who was willing to let us borrow money against our printing bill up to $100,000, and then she rolled it over at a bank so that she got the banknote. No bank would ever lend us money, partly because of the word feminist. The women officers of the bank were anxious, but they always had to answer to a male superior. There's still no woman in charge of a bank in this country, and or even of a branch.
Florence Howe is speaking in 1992.
And so the men always said no, even though the women presented a very good case. We're clearly earning our keep. All we need is capital. So I spend my time begging and patching. I borrow $10,000 in January from a board member and then pay it back in June, and then borrow another $10,000 from another person and pay it back in September. This year, because last year was such a good year for us, our sales went up nearly 20%. 32 books were out of stock at the end of December instead of the usual 18. This is out of a list of 113. And so I borrowed $30,000, and I will get only about 10 of those 38 books back into stock immediately. The rest will have to wait perhaps till next year. And of course, this is critical because these books are used mainly in courses. If you were in an English department somewhere, and my age, you probably know about the Feminist Press. But if you are a faculty member and in your 20s and 30s, you probably don't, because we have not had money the last 8 years to do advertising through the mail to new PhDs. That's one of the things we hope to do in the next year or two if we raise sufficient capital. So, why we're still in business. We still have enormous work to do. We have about 100 projects in the editorial office. At least 50 of them are fiction. Some of it is African fiction. Some of it is Asian fiction. And I've really talked about that in talking about the Indian anthology. But some of it is American. But it's not the kind of American we've seen before. It's Japanese American working class, for example, by a woman who's totally unknown except on the West Coast to a few specialists in short stories, who's in her late 60s, who's never going to write a novel. She writes plays part of the time. Who's self-taught. She's never been to college. She's sort of a Tilly Olson, but Japanese American, and who a creative writing teacher at the University of Oregon has discovered and thinks would be wonderful to have us do a book of her 12 short stories so that Japanese American students and others will have this wonderful volume. A huge volume was just sent to us. Ordinarily, people, if you know people who have managed, don't send them to me. What I prefer to have is a letter outlining what it is you think you might send to me, or a letter and a table of contents or a little sample, but don't send a manuscript ever to any publisher unless you know, or until you know, it's what that publisher does. Mostly, people who send manuscripts to me, I have to send them back, because we don't publish new fiction, we don't publish new poetry, we don't publish PhD theses, we don't publish drama, and so on. But this thing came, and it was the life's work, translated into English, of a Finnish woman who came to this country as a small child and became connected to a Finnish language newspaper that then became a magazine and that kept working Finns alive culturally in their own language as they became Americans. It was a national and regional magazine. And she was first a secretary, and then she was a worker on it, and she always wrote for it, but then she became the editor, and then she died. And as a memorial to her, dear friends had the whole thing translated by various hands, packed it up, and sent it to us. We gave it to Mary Jo Buell, who's worked with us for 2 decades, and we thought she'd have the time to read it because she had just gotten one of those Wonder Awards from the MacArthur people, and because she's always been involved in working class ethnic literature, and she has given it a totally rave review. So I thought, well, these would be wonderful things to publish, and I asked my distributor, who's a very good friend, a student of mine formerly at Goucher, who knows the Feminist Press, who was once co-director, and who really knows publishing, and who has helped get us into thousands of bookstores across the country, really cares about what we do. And she said, to both of those ideas, I don't think so. And I said, why not? I could not understand why not. And she said, well, she said, the Japanese stuff sells a little bit. She said, but the Finnish, you know, nobody knows her, and she's dead, and I just began to feel ill. But of course, it was also a moment of enlightenment. I understood why. Earlier this year, I was on a panel with a trade publisher who, after hearing me speak, said, I have just the manuscript for you. This is a great writer. She's dying of cancer. It's her last novel. There are other novels that are also great. They're out of print. She's in her 70s. You'll love it. So I said to him, well, you are a literary editor. Why don't you publish it if it's so great? He said, well, my list is very crowded right now. He said, I'll send it to you, see what you think. Now, he has called me constantly to see if I would publish that novel. And you see, and he's never wanted to. His list can't be filled forever, right? Why isn't he publishing it? And it suddenly occurred to me as I was talking to my distributor, who, as I say, is the best in the business, that obviously it is not the thing to do in commercial publishing to publish anyone who's dead or who's dying or who's only going to have one book, because what are commercial publishers interested in? Hype, right? You want the person on television. You want an attractive person to go around and sell books in bookstores. You want somebody to write a second book because the first book makes money. You don't want to end there. And in fact, in selling foreign rights, the houses in Sweden and Norway, for instance, that have Tilly Olsen and Alice Walker and Grace Paley will not take Paul Marshall. Why? I say Paul Marshall is as good as any of them. Well, because we can only do the writers we're doing because they are known. And so if they do another book, we'll do another book by them. But if we take another writer, we've got to get that writer known. And we can't do that. It's too much work. And besides, then we'd have to publish all of her books, and we can't do that. It's impossible. So they just stick with the ones they know. They won't even take new ones who are alive, right? They certainly won't take anyone who's dead. And I guess the last piece of evidence of that it just dawned on me. I haven't known this before. We published Now in November, won the Pulitzer Prize in 1934. It's one of the great novels of all times. No question in my mind. First novel, almost no one could believe that a 24-year-old slip of a girl had written a novel that won the Pulitzer Prize. It holds up, it's timeless, it's marvelous prose. It's the only 30s book that is anything as good as Tilly Olsen. No one will buy foreign rights. I've really tried to sell this to everybody in Scandinavia who buys American books, and to the people in Germany, for instance, who are doing American authors, who are very popular in Germany. Why won't they? Because she's dead. Is that incredible? So I guess that's still the last and probably the best reason why the feminist press has to go on, even though it's quite true the trade publishers are publishing women, university presses are publishing women, but they're not publishing dead women. It doesn't matter to them that these things are historically important.
Florence Howe, director of the Feminist Press. Her speech was recorded by Sally Jacques of the Foundation for a Compassionate Society.
This talk first aired in 1995 for the Feminist Press's 25th anniversary. In 2020, the press turned 50. Florence Howe has retired, and the new director is Jamia Wilson, a well-known young black writer, formerly vice president of programs at the Women's Media Center. Publishing on demand and e-publishing have reduced the capital needed to publish or reprint a book, and they do now publish work by living authors. Find their complete list and more at feministpress.org. For more about Wings, email wings@wings.org. Thanks to all our supporters, including Genevieve Vaughn, whose works can be found through the website forgiving.com. That's for-giving.com. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.